So this is gonna sound weird, but
okay,
I tried out a new gym on Monday and I can't move my arms.
I can't move my arms up, Ralphie. You ever seen Christmas Story?
Yes, I know. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Here's the entirety of A Christmas Story. All right, we open on Gimbals. It's a week before Christmas. You see Ralphie and his brother running up, pulling their parents along so that they can go up to the display case. Cut. Ralphie looking into this display case. Cut back to the display case. Inside, we start with a train that's going around and around, a Christmas scene within the train. Start to pan slowly up past the doll, past the nutcracker, all the way up. Narration going the entire time. Finally, we set our eyes on a Red Ryder BB gun with a compass in the stock. Important to the story. Cut back to Ralphie. They're getting pulled along for the Christmas parade. Cut. They're walking into the store because before the Christmas parade, they're going to do the last minute shopping. Cut. We're looking at an above view of the entirety of the store that they're in. We're looking at all of the people as they're walking through, and then they see a Santa Claus sitting up high above everyone else on this giant ice thing that has stairs on the right side and a really long silvery curvy slide that goes into what looks like cotton or some kind of indiscriminate fluff. Cut back. Ralphie asks, can they go see Santa? Cut to the mom. She says, yes, but take your brother along.
The way you're talking, it sounds like you have seen it.
I can't tell you how many times I have seen The Christmas Story.
It's probably similar to how many times I've seen The Muppets Christmas Carol.
I love The Muppets Christmas Carol.
I cannot watch it anymore. I like The Muppets, but it's just like I can't watch it anymore because we would watch it as children like so many times a year.
Oh my god. You know what's crazy is that if Kermit the Frog had been murdered, 9/11 wouldn't have happened.
I mean, you never know. Oh, this is like a thing that you didn't just say and make up.
Yeah, so A Very Muppet Christmas, you know the Very Muppet Christmas movie, which came out in 2002?
Is that the one that's just What a Wonderful Life, but with Muppets?
It's A Wonderful Life, but with Muppets. Yes, exactly. And at the point at which Kermit is going through his It's a Wonderful Life phase, the spirit that is taking him on the journey, the angel, opens a window and says, and this would be New York if you were never born. And what's still in New York? The Twin Towers. Therefore, if Kermit had never been born, the Twin Towers would have never fallen.
Oh my god. See, this is the kind of conspiracy theory we need. This one we can keep.
Redwood Soundwave.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Watch New Evil. This is Matt.
And this is Zach.
And today, we're going to be talking about the 1973 American supernatural horror film, The Exorcist, written by William Peter Blatty, directed and adapted for screen by William Friedkin, and starring the magnanimous, the possessimist, the one and only Linda Blair. Linda Blair, best part of this movie, Regan, the young girl who gets possessed, that's who Linda Blair is. She's playing with a Ouija board at the beginning of the movie, always a bad move. We start with her pissing on the floor. Zach, don't you think that at that point you would know something was wrong?
I mean, I don't know if you would be like, huh, possession, but like at that point, that's where her mom goes, oh yeah, she's sick, like I have to take her to a doctor. And at that point, I feel like that's a reasonable reaction. And it's not like Chris is a bad mother. She actually seems to be like a really good mother.
She's a very concerned mother and she's trying to make a life for her daughter.
Yeah, given that she's like an actress and a socialite and clearly like well-to-do. I feel like oftentimes in Hollywood, it's like, okay, this is the stereotype of they grew up affluent, so they didn't have like present parental figures. And that makes this a really good horror movie because it doesn't play into that stereotype. It doesn't play into that trope of like,
not at all.
maybe what we think is a demonic possession is really just a metaphor for feelings of neglect. And it's not. It's just scary.
Yeah. In fact, the movie references this because it talks about how the mother would spend all of her time off with her daughter. And I think that this is especially relevant because we're also in a situation where there's no paternal figure, which, as unrelated as that might sound or patriarchal as it might seem, is in fact relevant to the story in the same way that it is relevant in a sequel to The Conjuring, where the lack of the male figure in the house denotes some sort of instability within the home. And we do get that there's a little bit of friction between Regan and her mother, partially because of the filming schedule, like her time is so monopolized and she's trying to be an ideal figure in the public, obviously maintaining a strong image, maintaining a solid workload so that she's staying relevant. But she is trying to be a good mother. However, it is insinuated that because of her absence, much of the time, Regan is forced to kind of spend time alone, invent all of these creatures. She's very artistic. She has an imaginary friend that I don't think has anything to do with Pazuzu. I do think that the imaginary friend is wholly imaginary, but it's supposed to symbolize the fact that there is enough distance for Pazuzu to infiltrate her mind.
That's interesting. They definitely introduce this idea of the occult early on with the Ouija board and her mentioning that Captain Howdy speaks to her through it. And like then they bring it up later, like, hey, is it Captain Howdy that's like living inside you right now? And she goes, I don't know. It definitely seems out of Pazuzu's nature to make her say, I don't know. Pazuzu seems pretty loud and proud. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so yeah. I feel like he would have taken credit for that.
Oh, I disagree.
You think he would have been more cunning at that point?
Yeah, because so much of what Pazuzu is doing is playing mind games. And I think that that's why he switches personas so rapidly. Because especially the first one, he's trying to make the father go away, right? He's trying to make everybody get out of there. Obviously, Pazuzu is trying to stay out of the radar of the church, the only people who would be capable of stopping him. And it's just so along the path that Daddy Priest comes in and finds out that there's stuff going on that's demonic through the mother.
That's what's interesting about this movie, right? Is that it could be a lot shorter. I think this movie's runtime is like an hour 57 minutes or something. It's very close to 2 hours. And yeah, it could probably be half the length, but what it does cinematically and what it does with atmosphere is so important, especially for its time. It does not seem like it came out in 1973. It feels like much more mature.
Oh, very much so. And it's very thoughtful.
Right. They do so much work with like silhouettes and building the atmosphere, not only to be like spooky and paranormal and, you know, off kilter, but also serious. This could have been kind of a goofy movie.
Oh, easily.
She's spewing these bodily fluids and, you know, it could have been kind of goofy taken with a certain context, but they do such a good job building the atmosphere. And the fact that, so it's in Georgetown, which is, it's an academic area. We see the university, there is a lot of churches, they show...
Oh, yeah, you have to have a good church in a horror movie.
Priests and the nuns, you know, walking around kind of campus and all that stuff. So it's, I think that helps a lot, especially introducing Father Damien, who appears to have lost his faith and got this background in psychiatry. The Ivy League setting kind of like makes sense for him because he has gone to like all the best medical schools and has all the best medical training.
Which of course is supposed to represent the way in which he is oppositional to the church.
The internal strife within him is really interesting because he does have this background in science, but also is a priest. This is supposed to be him finding or refinding his faith. He even mentions that when he got in psychiatry and when he's working in psychiatry, a lot of problems in people came down to faith. And then he immediately admits after that to losing his faith. And then his mother ends up in a psychiatric ward. And this was your first time watching this movie, right?
This was my first time seeing The Exorcist. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. And we were watching it, and I'm like, I just didn't believe you the whole time. And I'm still not sure I believe you.
I had never seen The Exorcist, but I had seen so many clips of The Exorcist. Like, I knew the movie
You saw beat the big for parts. Beat.
Saw all the big parts. I saw Linda Blair pissing on the floor in Scary Movie 2. And so the whole time I'm like watching The Exorcist, my experience is like, oh my gosh, this is beautifully shot. I don't remember it looking like this when I saw it before. Well, the issue is I'd never seen it in its actual filmed form. I had seen it in some stylized or over edited like clip version of it, but I had never seen it start to finish.
Like I said earlier, I was talking about atmosphere and all that stuff, but like the movie moves so slow. It works because that balances all the crazy stuff that's happening with these mundane conversations that are just happening, like, and driving the plot forward between Reagan having her head spin around or, you know, projectile vomiting demon goo onto a priest. There's so much stuff that was shocking that they showed a child that was possessed by a demon doing on screen at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh. That they kind of had to balance this stuff out with these somewhat mundane conversations, but also, you know, the character development, not so much of Reagan, because we don't really get anything from her other than I want a horse and she gets possessed.
we get Pazuzu's character development. We do not, in fact, get Reagan's character development.
Yeah, I guess let's talk Pazuzu, right? In real life, Pazuzu's lore, I feel like, is very different than what we see in this movie.
Remind me, Pazuzu is from the Lesser Key of Solomon?
Pazuzu is from ancient Mesopotamian lore.
Right, but is it cataloged in the Lesser Key of Solomon?
Oh, I don't think so. This is some primordial shit.
My favorite part was when it first showed the Pazuzu statue, I was like, oh my god. Why would they have this? The penis. It has a giant penis.
The endowment. He's got a serpentine penis. He's also got a scorpion's tail, I guess? He's a chimera. He presents as a chimera, unless he's inhabiting the body of a 12-year-old girl. What's interesting is that he has nothing to do with Catholic Church, as a lot of demon in these paranormal movies kind of, like, normally do have some connection to either the Lesser Key of Solomon, or just, like, they're just straight up the Antichrist, or whatever.
Demons are unconcerned by the Catholic Church, but the Catholic Church likes to make it very apparent that demons only care about them, which I find hilarious.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
That's the crux and downfall of the Vatican, is them finding out that demons, you're not even on their radar. It's like an exorcist shows up and the demon's like, and you are, it's like, oh, I'm Father O'Malley. Don't you know who I am? It's just like, no, have we met? They have other more important things to do, but also it's like they're domain and their kind of territory, their hunting grounds are global. They're not isolated to a small, now independent town in Italy. Like, nobody cares.
Hell kind of transcends the dimension that we live in, doesn't it?
How narcissistic of the Catholic Church to think that they have fully consumed the attention of every demon.
Oh my god, if you want to, like, really be scared, look up Inuit spirits and demons.
Now, are those in the Lesser Key of Solomon?
No, not at all. And
you're not gonna let me flex my Lesser Key of Solomon knowledge, are you?
We talked so much about the Lesser Key of Solomon.
So Pazuzu, I think, is a fascinating character study within the film because, yes, he plays dumb. And I think that that's kind of the most important part about demons, is that on some level, on some nature versus nurture-esque level, all demons are trying to fly under the radar. All demons, and that's the thing, Pazuzu, like, entered Reagan and then became crazy face, and it's like, somebody's gonna notice that. Pazuzu, at that point, had to have had the confidence, the full confidence, that he could easily take over and thrive in the outside world without priest intervention.
I don't think I agree at all.
You don't think that Pazuzu was hubris incarnate?
Well, I think there's definitely hubris involved. I think it's more that he was luring Father Merrin. I think
he had Father Merrin some specifically
beef with Lancaster Merrin. He's the one who took that totem in Egypt. There's a really great shot of Lancaster, and he's standing like opposite of the Pazuzu statue in Egypt.
Yeah.
And it's like this really cool shot, and just like it's seared into my mind. My point is that there is the whole setup at the beginning in Egypt, right, with Father Merrin, and then he comes to the house. He is the exorcist, the namesake of the movie. He comes to the house, and immediately when he enters the house, Reagan / Pazuzu goes, Merrin! Right? It's like a con moment. And that to me is like, he's arrived. This was my goal the whole time. And then he kills him. I think it was like he had some beef with Father Merrin and he wanted him dead.
I don't think that he kills him. I, in fact, think that the opposite. I think that Pazuzu is unsatisfied because he didn't kill Merrin.
How did he die then? Just
he died of a heart attack, because that's why he was taking those pills.
Right, right,
because
right.
The pills, as I looked up, they were meant to ease the pain of heart attacks. And because we saw him in Egypt, we knew that he was already having heart attacks. And so he was having one there. I don't think it was Pazuzu specifically.
I think it was due to Pazuzu's presence, but then it's not just Pazuzu. I think we have to be clear on that, because we're kind of also shown the fault of Father Merrin's thinking, where Father Damien, he said, he's like, there are three personalities in Reagan, and Merrin is like, no, it's just Pazuzu. He's just being a tricksy demon, and you know, we said, gotta get rid of him. From what I have heard, I think they get into that more with the sequels.
Well, I think it's also interesting that they say she has three personalities in her, because obviously it's the anti-Trinity. And that's why he also claims to be the devil, but he's not really the devil, right? He's Pazuzu.
Right, right. It's interesting like how there's not like a definitive answer, which I think is really realistic as far as a paranormal demon possession movie can be realistic, but there's just so much at the end that happens like really quickly, right? I think that it was Pazuzu's goal to kill Father Merrin, or to see Father Merrin die or whatever, but then also there is this transference from Reagan to Damien, and then Damien immediately throws himself out the window. Do you think, this is something I've wondered a lot while watching this movie before, do you think that it would be possible for this demon or demons or whatever to inhabit the body of a priest that wasn't Father Damien?
Yes.
My thinking was, because Damien has lost his faith, saw himself as like the possible vessel to like ultimately defeat the demons.
I had interpreted that Damien had regained his faith in the forgiveness, because they do not a confession, but Father Merrin absolves him of sin before he goes back in and sees Father Merrin dead. And so I think that actually Damien has in fact refound his faith, and that's what gave him the strength to literally beat the devil out of Reagan.
Yeah, he really does beat her.
It's crazy.
It's hard to tell though, right? Because there isn't, and again, it's not, this is something to be admired, I think, where there's not this moment where it's like, he has his faith back, and like, you know, rock ballad plays in the background, and he has his mojo back or whatever. I think that's to be admired. It's not white and black. This is written so well because it leaves room for interpretation in that way. But I can see it either way. How do you denounce the existence of a god or, you know, heaven or hell when you know there's a demon that's possessing this little girl?
Yeah. Well, I think that it's also very important that you consider the demon was not able to enter Damien until he ripped the necklace free. The medallion that he had was a Saint Joseph medallion. So Joseph was the patron saint of families, fathers, and travelers.
And you know what? They kind of foreshadow that, don't they? Because his collar
several times
ripped off a few times.
It is as if Pazuzu knows, because Damien's yelling at him. He's saying, take me, take me. And the demon is not able to move into Damien until that necklace is gone. So that necklace is almost kind of a symbolic use of faith to shed faith for the protection of another, because you also have to think that if he is a priest, he is making the huge sacrifice to kill himself, which is obviously Jesus. He's saving the world from sin, literally, through Pazuzu and possession, by killing himself. Although, it's really, really tricky when you start to get into ideas of, like, what suicide is for the Catholic Church, which is, like, it's one of the gravest sins that you can commit. And, in fact, in the Inferno, you get turned into a tree. He does that so that he can, you know, protect the world. I think that that has something to do with it, and it also shows how the faith transfers, because Reagan gets the medallion, and now she kind of is going to carry on the legacy of the church.
Well, and then she also, she like kisses the one priest on the cheek or whatever afterwards. Yeah. So she like it's showing she's like she has this appreciation for the faith. But it's also like you're bringing up Father Damien's death, and I do want to talk about the staircase, right? So he throws himself out the window and dies in the same spot as Burke, the film director, right?
Yeah, who also killed himself.
Well, it's assumed that he was thrown out the window by Reagan. I don't know, maybe just possessed to do so. I don't know.
Here's my theory on this. He drove Burke to kill himself.
I could agree with that.
I was thinking that, like, Pazuzu had maybe possessed Burke, but then killed him, had him kill himself, or that drove him to kill himself because of the demon, and then Reagan.
It could almost be anything.
Yeah, like, it just didn't make sense after I had worked it out, but
I mean, he's got some telekinesis stuff going on, right? So he just could have, like, force-pushed Burke out the window.
Right, but he can't touch the priests, or he doesn't. There's something stopping Pazuzu from really directly harming people, because you'd think if Pazuzu had the kind of power that they show, he'd be able to, like, just get the priests out of the door. Unless he's so arrogant that he thinks that they're not going to be able to do anything. Which, kind of true.
What's the fun of that? From a demon's perspective, if his goal is truly to antagonize, he's pushed the people out of the room. Like, what's the fun of that? So, anyways, back to the staircase. I think it's supposed to be like, you know, we have this
stairway,
like,
to heaven.
Stairway to heaven, but they're saying they fell down the stairs. I think it's more supposed to be like hell.
Stairway to hell.
Because yeah. Burke is like really shown to be this terrible human being, right?
Yeah, highway to hell.
And then Father Damien does, like you said, commit suicide, which is a hellbound sin. So I think it's kind of supposed to be that, but it's also shown to be like Burke didn't actually fall down the stairs, he fell out the window. So it's kind of like they implant the idea, but then they toy with it, which I think they do a lot of in the writing of this, which is just like, it's part of why it works so well for me. There are just more and more questions as you go along.
Yeah.
And
do you know why I like it so much?
Because I like
it. Chiaroscuro. You know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
Chiaroscuro is the treatment of light in paintings. And so it's the heavy, heavy, heavy contrast. So you know the girl with the pearl earring?
Yes.
What makes that painting so striking is that she is up against a super deep black. So everything about her features get pushed super far forward because it's a play of the light. And that, I think, is one of the things that Friedkin did so well. Just as you said, like, juxtaposing the images of Pazuzu and the Father, for me, it was the juxtaposition of characters in darkness, characters in light. The infamous scene of Marin getting out of the taxi and standing underneath the streetlight, right? Beautiful shot. Yeah. And that is cinematic lighting. My other favorite one that I thought was super striking was when you had Chris at the, I want to say it was the police office, or it was at one of the one-on-ones with a doctor, where she's in the foreground, and because she's in the foreground, she's a black figure, and then the other guy is in the background, and he's the lit figure, because it's playing with the idea that Chris is literally in the dark about what's going on. And she's in a dark place because she can't figure out what's happening. Versus the other guy who's, like, supposed to be enlightened. He's supposed to be helpful. And we always kind of push two things against each other, black and white, heaven and hell. We always depict angels in white and demons in black, so it's like good and evil. Yeah. I think that that was kind of the thing that really drew me to this film was the lighting is so beautiful, and every time that the light changes, it has some sort of cinematic parallel or character-driven parallel, and I loved that.
Well, and kind of going along with that contrast is like also, this is just another thing that's like genius with the writing and direction is that what they show versus what they don't. They show a lot of the procedural kind of stuff that's happening with the priests. Like Lancaster is taking the cross out very slowly and he takes his holy water out and you see him taking him out of the bag and then you see him like unzipping the thing and take it. It's so slow and then he's slowly opening the Bible and we get stuff like that, waiting for something to happen, and then we don't even get shown Burke's death.
Yeah.
That, I think, has to do with the pacing and the writing of it, but I find myself watching the really mundane parts of this movie and being like, yes, this is what it's about. And it just seems like really weird and like it shouldn't work or something, but it just does. Like, it feels great then when we do get some kind of resolution, or maybe not resolution, but like something happens. And it's like, okay, that happened in like half a second, but there is so much of this buildup.
And I like that this movie is giving us all of those buildups in sequence, right? We really have a great juxtaposition of cinematic action, because that's the thing that I think a lot of movies miss is how we get to the climax. Everything is the hero's journey. Not everything needs to be the hero's journey.
Yes.
And this one, it was fairly blasé action. We weren't super, you know, engaged in what was going on other than the setup. Then something pretty significant and pretty severe happens. We hit a really strong emotional beat with the death of Karis's mother. Super strong emotional beat. And then it starts rolling and rolling. And we have a lot of blank areas. And then we have Halloween party. Big event. The big events keep building up and building up, where we're juxtaposing huge emotional peaks and then slow building action. That when all hell breaks loose, it can sustain how crazy the actual action is. It has the audiences then have the capacity to take in all of the insanity because we've been well primed from the beginning.
Right. You're receptive.
It's actually kind of asymmetric, like the film in general, because the very first scene when they're back in ancient Egypt is really action-packed, big cast, a lot of stuff going on. And then the ending scene is the exact opposite. The second scene, which is really boring stuff and is independent character development, juxtaposed against the second to last scene.
Completely,
which is the craziest. Yeah, so it like it pins them all really well against each other. You get this kind of interesting mirror image, which I think mirrors are also significant throughout the film.
It's just paced in a very unique way that just works so well. And I think that's why we see the two different versions of the movie, right? Everyone, like when they think The Exorcist, they think the spider walk down the stairs. We watched it, and I actually I guess I've always seen like the part with that deleted scene in there. That's a deleted scene. And I think it's actually a better movie without it. I know it's really weird to say, but have something like that at that moment in the movie just doesn't feel right.
It does a really good job of supplanting the idea that there's a demon without going so physical.
Right. And that's right after Burke's death.
Yeah.
To have them wondering where he is and being like, oh, well, why did he leave Reagan by herself? And then she floats upside down the stairs. Whatever. It just seems like, oh, look, a demon, you know? It just seems like it kind of ruins the tension of the moment. But it's a creative and haunting image, I will say that.
Yeah.
Speaking of cinematography, that just sticks with you, I think, is the slowness of the power of Christ compels you. As Reagan, like, is floating above the bed and then slowly lowers. And just the repetition of that is also really haunting.
The power of Christ compels you.
You can feel the desperation of it in the moment. And, like, just the absolute effort that it is for them. And it just, it's like this, it just builds the tension so much. Because you're like, is it going to work? And it takes so long to work.
And ultimately, Did it?
It doesn't. Yeah, it's just like, okay, intermission. But then there's the first kind of test, the first time Damien comes in and like he's like, this is holy water, and then throws it on her. And because he's just like, ah, right? He's freaking out because he thinks it's holy water, but it's not actually holy water. And so Damien's like, she's faking it.
Oh,
this,
yeah.
This is not a possession. But right. I think that's...
He's faking it.
Right. And I think that's what's interesting about this is in watching this now, being a bit older than last time and like when I was super into this movie, is the seeming like hypochondria of Reagan and her mother. Her mom thinks that there is definitely something wrong with her. Like, it's definitely something where they feel like it's something that necessitates psychiatric intervention rather than religious intervention. And they go through a lot of stuff. That's kind of like a slow part of the middle of the movie. I think it's also powerful that there is no father figure because it's Chris going to all these doctors and being like, what is wrong with her? And
oh, yeah. And having to deal with being a woman trying to get medical care in the 70s. Woof.
For your daughter. It's not for your like daughter. Even, like if it was a son, that would have been a different story probably. But
yeah,
it's an interesting situation that they're portraying here. Even heightens the desperation more. You're feeling for Chris. You're feeling for Reagan by the time the word exorcism is even thrown out. Right. And you're like, yeah, just do the exorcism. You know, like, I feel like in a lot of movies, it's like, you got a demon in your house here. I know these paranormal experts. Something weird happens with the paranormal experts. They're like, hey, I know a guy. He's a priest. And like, that's the laying of events. This is like, she's tried everything. Her daughter's head is still spinning around.
Yeah. The head spinning one is always so funny to me because it's like, come on, demons. Owls have been doing that for centuries.
Like, we ain't scared of that.
Yeah, it's like we've seen this before, and it's like they did it first. But you know what else owls did first? Learn how to possess humans.
You talking about the staircase?
No, I once knew a guy that was possessed by an owl. You know him too. Say it.
What?
Ask.
Oh, you want me to say who, and then you're going to be like, it's him!
Yeah, it's him. Congrats, you figured out the joke. Thank you everyone for listening to this week's episode of Watch No Evil. This was Matt.
This is Zach.
And remember, the power of Christ compels you to subscribe to our Patreon.
Check out all the content brought to you by Redwood Sound Labs. Listen to the new show that will help you live a better life with your beloved pets. It handles topics like proper food, nutrition, positive reinforcement training, and more. Certified dog behavior consultant Charlotte Peltz welcomes your pet concerns and questions in Living With Your Dog. Zach and Matt are two veteran horror movie enthusiasts discussing their favorite and not so favorite films. Spoilers abound, so scary movie fans beware. Watch no evil. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient and cinematographer. Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together, they explore the narrative, effective, and production politics of war cinema on the Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project. You can find all these shows wherever you find podcasts.